Hey everybody, Michael Thiessen here, and today I get to interview Barbara Kay. Barbara has been a columnist for the National Post since 2003, and since 2019, she's been a regular columnist for the Epoch Times newspaper. I first was intrigued by her work a number of weeks ago when I got to hear her give a lecture to the Ontario Party, and that lecture was on trans activism and its negative effects in Canadian and international sport. So, Barbara, thank you so much for coming on and having this discussion. I've been looking forward to it the moment Nicole said that we had arranged an interview.
Oh, I've been looking forward to it as well, and I'm flattered that you liked my talk to the Ontario Party enough to want to interview me. It's a pleasure to be here, Michael.
So, we talked a little bit off camera, and so you know this question is coming, but I want to talk a little bit in a broader sense about journalism, because the integrity of journalism, you've got a multiple, you know, forms of journalism, investigative journalism, and then you said, you know, you focus on opinion pieces. What is your general feeling on the condition of journalism in Canada and in the United States? I know that Ben Shapiro often uses the phrase, we don't really have journalism anymore, we have journalisming. He plays on that word a little bit. How is your feeling as you sit back and look at our newspapers to what you see going out in print?
Print journalism, I'm sure you realize, is not what it was when I started 20 years ago. Print journalism was still buoyant. It was still a very healthy medium, but it was already you could sort of see the clouds on the horizon with the internet, the rise of the internet, the rise of social media, and the loss of revenues to all the print media because so much of their expenses were carried by people advertising in print newspapers, and that all kind of shifted away to the internet. So they had to really scramble. They cut a lot of their budget. They cut a lot of their journalism staff. They cut in all kinds of ways, and so it became less, how shall I say, of the kind of authoritative voice, you know, for getting the news out and for getting, so I mean, you still have the big papers, the New York Times and the Toronto Star and the, you know, and the National Post got in at the last minute, really, for in the growth stage of newspapers. So you still have big newspapers, but you also have a tremendous number of online papers that are generally married to one philosophy or ideology or the other. We have social media that has influenced, has caused journalism or journalisming, as Ben puts it, to become more of an activist kind of activity rather than a reportage. In the old days, there was a very distinct firewall between the news side of a newspaper and the opinion side. Now, I mean, the editorial side, and now so many of our mainstream media have become really, the front page is as editorial as the editorial section. Young people going into journalism today come out of the universities with all that that entails. They are very much in the mold of believing that you can't be neutral. There's no such thing as neutrality on the important subjects of our day. And they come to journalism with a kind of missionary zeal, you know, to bring social justice to the world, and that they think that's their job. They also think it's their job to tell the owners and publishers of these papers and these outlets what their job should be. So you get these funny things happening, like 200 journalists signing an open letter to to their publishers, telling them what they don't like their stance on, say, the Middle East. And it should be this stance, you know. It seems very odd to me that young journalists think they have the right to tell publishers and you know, very experienced staff, their superiors, what they should be writing about and what approach they should take. And so this is something entirely in the last 20 years that has come about that never was before. Social media, Facebook, Twitter, Substacks. It's a very much a world in flux now. But the fact that there need to be, I don't know if you read a lot of the Substacks that are out there now. You know, Substacks are like your own personal little newspaper that
I would suggest that Liberty Coalition Canada fits in that category, maybe a little bit, where we're producing information and forwarding articles.
Yeah, and original content. And podcasts like this, it's wonderful. So there's been an explosion of alternate forms, but most of the alternate forms, because so many of them were formed in resistance to being sucked into this ideological, on the left and on the right too. The right is more or less a resistance movement to the left, you might say, which has gone further and further and further left from what used to be liberalism. Now we're, you know, deep into progressivism that seems to have no end, culturally anyways. And so you get the kind of divisions that there's very few people in the middle anymore. What used to be mainstream journalism with just plain old reportage for the main part of the newspaper and then, you know, very well-crafted opinion pieces based in evidence and argued with, you know, the old rules of debate and all that, that seems to have fallen by the wayside. And so I'm trying to think. I think a very good example for one example is you get a publication like The New Yorker, which I would say has more prestige in literary circles and amongst left-leaning. It was never a far-left publication until, I don't even know if it's far-left now, but in any case, it was about literary pursuits and knowledge and culture and in the broadest sense. And then it sort of started going left. So one of their star performers or their star writers is Woody Allen's estranged son, Farrow, F-A-R-R-O-W, at The New Yorker, who really hates Woody Allen because he believes that his sister was sexually abused by him when she was a child. And there's no real evidence except her own story or her own belief for that. And so he wrote a couple of articles in which he took it for granted that Woody Allen is a sex abuser, child sex abuser. And it was riddled with errors. I mean, factual errors. Now, it's such a serious allegation. Years ago, that would have been a firing offense. Nothing happened to him. And in fact, his book, it was Woody Allen's book, his memoir, that was pulled from publication. Not his son's book, that his adoptive son's book, that should have been. Examples like that, they're all over the place where you start to get experienced editors fired because they used the wrong word in a headline. It wasn't woke enough. After many, many years of service, this happened at the New York Times. You had, I think, you know, the Substack movement got a real shot in the arm when a reporter at the New York Times, she wasn't a reporter, she was a senior editor at the New York Times. And she, in the opinion section, Barry Weiss, and she was hounded because she took the wrong stance on Israel. She was pro-Israel. And her colleague simply harassed her unmercifully, and her editors wouldn't stand up because they were so afraid of the staff that they sort of just kept quiet about it. And she finally said, she wrote a big essay about her leaving. She said, I can't take this. She left. She started her own Substack. She's doing amazing. She's making, I think, 4 or 5 times what she was making at the New York Times. And you have all kinds of people. And the most reasonable people are the ones that are leaving the publications. In fact, I myself left the National Post for a while. I think I'm pretty reasonable. And I left the National Post. At one point, the National Post seemed to have lost its way a little bit because they were having their staff were having a union drive, and they were being very careful about upsetting the apple cart in terms of not allowing too much anti-woke material in the opinion section. And I had been feeling very constrained because, you know, I was writing like I always did, but my several of my columns were starting to be spiked, the kind of columns that never would have been spiked before. So eventually, and a lot of them were on the trans issue. Yes. So I did walk out.
I want to jump in there and kind of jump off of that conversation for a minute, in the sense that you said a few very telling things. You said it seems some of the most reasonable people are the ones leaving these major newspapers in order to start their own Substack. And I would say Substack's like a direct communication with your own viewers. So different formats, but news going out kind of independently almost. Am I understanding that correctly?
Correct. It is independent, which is good in the sense that it allows the person writing to have their own guests or to deal with issues as they without fear of censorship. The bad news is they're basically talking to their own choirs. And so it means that, you know, when you used to read a newspaper, you'd often get, in the opinion section anyways, you'd often get conflicting opinions. Like, good newspapers would always have, at least, no matter what their general philosophy was, they used to have at least one contrarian on the editorial board and writing as a columnist. And that's a good thing. You should be forced to know what you're up against or what other people believe, so that you can hone your own debating skills. I that's sort of a classical liberal kind of approach to the public forum, is
learning rhetoric and learning civil discourse in the midst of a controlled and benevolent debate format is always helpful. It's never pleasing, and I am a debater at heart, and so I, regardless of those moments, I always want to go for the jugular and win. But that's literally something that we need to, that's failing in the education system, is the area of logic and rhetoric, where you are having a student have to think through and then dialogue about what their beliefs are and learn in that format.
But they don't get that now.
Because they don't get that now. And the good, and like you said, the most common sense ones seem to be the ones that are leaving. You said a few other telling things that I want to draw our listeners' attention to. I want you to comment on this. In the midst of the social media world, I would have thought that the big publications would have wanted to stay in the investigative. We were talking about this yesterday, and the way I described it is where a newspaper journalist saw themselves telling other people's stories. I went to this event. This is what happened. A plus B, C, D. And I thought that with the rise of social media, where in that world it is more opinion, that the rigorous investigative journalist would shine for just presenting information of which all of us could then jump off of with opinions. And also the other side of it is with the social media world, we can so easily fact check ourselves. So when you talk about that story, I think it was Ronan Farrow was the name you were looking for.
Thank you.
Yeah. And by the way, everybody, I just went and looked that up because Barbara asked me to. When you say that he factually, you know, made errors, it, with the rise of the internet, with the rise of social media, the ability to check it and also share that those errors are wrong are so extreme that you would think that journalists would be more careful to be able to say, no, I can prove that that is right. And then at the same time, you would also think that they would be more careful because if more information is there to be brought forward, they're more liable. And they're more liable to face defamation and slander attacks because the evidence is so ready.
You're right. It is checkable. And what's very interesting is he was fact-checked and people were responding on Twitter saying he got this wrong, he got that wrong. And putting myself in his place, or I was, if I get something wrong in one of my columns, I'm mortified, even if it's a date. Even if it's like I by mistake I say 1914 instead of 1960, like that I get very angry at myself. And if it's a more important error, I actually get like a panic attack. So for me, getting facts right is extremely important because I don't want people debating my ability to research or my sloppiness as a researcher. I want them debating my ideas. And also, I want the respect of my editor and my publication. I mean, I'm very old school in that respect, but when I went to university, that's what your professors did. They were interested in hearing what you had to say, but they weren't interested in only your opinions coming out of your lived experience. They wanted you to make an argument, and it had to be a good argument. And if you left out obvious sources or you left, you know, or your sources were dubious. Look, what's happening today, some of the most egregious investigative mistakes, like the Trump and the Russia.
Right. Yeah. No, absolutely. You've got a ton of different.
So it was unbelievable how many newspapers did not want to do the investigative work. And they deliberately didn't. Or in the case, say, of the Daily Post, when they did do the investigative work on say, the Hunter Biden laptop story, Twitter took it off. I mean, you've got players now, big tech players, that are so ideologically or they're so politically committed to their agenda that... And it's very, and the anger, the emotion invested in these, between the Trumpists and the anti-Trumpists, look, I just read this morning, I never thought in my lifetime I would read that the Supreme Court justices of the United States have been offered security details at their homes because there's so many people that are so infuriated at that leak, which in itself, on the Roe versus Wade draft, that's a terrible thing to have.
Well, and not only the leak itself was terrible, never has happened in U.S. history. Then number two, then the personal addresses of the justices were leaked. It goes back to your point, and I'm staying on one train of thought. And there were all these little nuggets you offered in your first section, and this last.
Keep bringing me back. I tend to ramble, so don't feel bad if you have to corral me. You know,
that's fine. I don't feel like any of my listeners would ever be able to say that someone could out ramble Mike Thiessen. So on the very beginning. We were talking about how social media caused a cut in budgets and a cut in investigative journalism. And it's, you didn't bring this conclusion, but it came up in my mind, and that would be this. It might be easier to sell the opinion and to have financial support out of the political ideological sphere than just your good old-fashioned advertisers if you're presenting the truth. The reason why I'm saying that is because, again, you would think with the rise of social media that real investigative journalism would be treasured. It would be like, because you said this really important thing, Barbara, that when you got a date wrong, it caused you to, you know, caused you anxiety. Because we think that we all want to tell the truth. But even in the opinion world, I don't like it when I get it wrong. Like, it's one thing to outright tell a knowable lie and so, an editor look at that and go, yeah, sources are all bad. Tons of error. Can so-and-so have a look at this? Yeah, this is awful. And we're still going to run with it, which is knowingly lying, knowingly defaming. That's got to have an instigation of money behind it somewhere. And there's a difference between getting that wrong, which is fraud, and then in the opinion world, even getting it wrong. So I remember we did a podcast right after the emergency measures were pulled. And it was all opinion because we try to present the facts very quickly on our podcast, but then we quickly do get to opinion. And so I remember saying, you know, 50 times on the podcast, you know, Canada's never going to be out of the emergency. It's all doomed, you know, everything. And then literally before we had released the podcast, the emergency measures were over. And we had to shoot a podcast and say we got it completely wrong. Now, none of the facts that we were sharing were wrong. We were all confident with the facts. I feel bad enough that I got the opinion part wrong.
You didn't get it wrong. You looked at the facts and you drew a conclusion. Look at the banks on inflation. They're apologizing now because they came to a conclusion based on what they saw as the evidence. I mean, it's okay to come to a conclusion that turns out to be wrong when you're an opinion journalist. I've had opinions that turned out, I've made predictions. I'm very careful about predictions because I have a terrible track record. But but if I have amassed what I think is convincing evidence to suggest that what I'm predicting is a possibility or a strong possibility, I don't feel so bad. I'm always happy to say that I'm pleasantly surprised, because really, nobody knows, you know, even if a trend is going a certain way, you can never say 100% that it's, you can never say that people aren't finally going to say, whoa, even when they're on a bad track. And sometimes it's interesting about how quickly things can turn around. You know, who saw the Berlin Wall coming down in 1989? I mean, it's things are going on under the surface. I think the best opinion columnists, and I don't put myself amongst them, are the people that look at what's on the surface and read what's going on underneath as this trend is going to continue or no, we're at a pivotal moment and it's going to, things are going to turn around. And when they do, they're going to turn around quickly. So I don't see myself in that category. I tend to read, I read the situation the way it's going, and I tend to think if nothing intervenes, it's going to get worse. And when I look at our cultural situation, the reason I assume it will get worse is because, you know, you talk about investigative journalism, you'd think it would be heralded and it would, but if the investigation leads to a conclusion or what looks like it might be a conclusion that goes against the narrative that everybody in high places has decided on politically and that corporations are invested in it. You know, I'm just as an example, I'm in a sort of forum, a chat, an email kind of round robin with scholars of Indigenous affairs. And they know their subject, I mean, in great, great, great detail. And they don't buy into the narrative that we're a genocidal country or that the residential schools were all horror shows akin to Auschwitz. I mean, there's an exaggerated the bad things that happened in the past. This is history. Bad things happen all the time in history. But eventually, you have to acknowledge what has happened and move forward. And on this issue, we're not moving forward because the kind of moral panic about the so-called cultural genocide. And I say so-called because, yeah, I call the residential schools forced assimilation. And forced assimilation has happened in many places in history when the dominant group feels that unless the minority group is forced to assimilate, they will remain marginalized, poor, out of the mainstream, a burden to the government, a burden to themselves, unhappy, everybody unhappy. And sometimes you're at a point in history where, you know, if you're going to share the same space and you're going to all be citizens together, everybody has to make accommodations. And one of the accommodations that it seems logical to governments, or did, was these children have to learn English. They have to learn life skills. They can't depend on trapping animals and fishing forever because there's not enough food for them. They are already, the fur trade had, you know, I won't go into all the background of why the residential schools were considered necessary. All I can say is
that I would love to interview anybody who would be willing to talk at length and intelligently about that situation.
Well, give me 5 minutes and I'll come up with 4 or 5 people. I know them.
Because Barbara, it's critical theory exploiting a historical moment. That is what's going on right now. And you talked about the terror of the moral bankruptcy that our country feels. It's just being exploited with critical theory. And so I would love to have an at-length conversation about that. And I feel like you have opened the can for my listeners to go, okay, I'm going to be listening for that. But I do want to go into your trans activism material and your area. From what you've said so far, I agree with you on the residential schools. There's a forced assimilation, and we could have a rigorous debate as to whether or not there is any validity to that. And then the flip side of that is there are also realities on the ground that continue to be ignored. Like, I remember sitting with one of my senior citizens in my church talking about the 60s scoop and how just recently there was $70 million awarded to individuals in that. And I was sitting with this senior from our church and she was saying, I remember that moment. They were pleading with us to help take these children who were sitting in their own feces, who were struggling to survive, who were being neglected. Back in the 60s, that moment in time was seen as a great accomplishment of people caring and loving children. What it's being touted as right now is simply, it's being weaponized for the critical theory movement.
And, well, more than that, it's weaponized for money. And one professor who got fired from her university, Frances Widdowson, for her rigorous scholarship, she's very open about her belief that this is an industry. She calls it a race hustle, but she backs it up with a lot of evidence. And I think that the moment, I would hope that you would speak with one of these scholars. I'd be happy to provide you with a list of wonderful guys and women who are really experts on this subject. And it's a good time to talk about it because since the discovery, you know, people have talked to me, oh, but what about the mass graves at Kamloops? And I'm like, there's no mass graves at Kamloops. We don't even know if there's graves at Kamloops. An archaeologist found soil disturbances. So far, there hasn't been the discovery of one grave or one child or one anything, but the media picked up that story and the use of the word unmarked graves, that's at least, but mass graves, that is a word that should never, ever be used outside of Babi Yar or the Holocaust or whatever. The New York Times used that trope, mass graves, and I thought, wow, you want to talk about irresponsible journalism. And every time I say to somebody, but they haven't found any graves, they found soil disturbances and they haven't excavated. Not a single grave, not a single alleged grave has been excavated in a year. Anyways, you don't want to waste time on this subject, so let's go on. But I think this brought things to a head, and a lot of scholars got just so... They said enough is enough, and they won't let us publish, and they don't want to hear from us. And although I have to say, the National Post did publish one or two of these scholars, and good for them, because really it's very tough to get any contrarian view on this subject published. There's a narrative, nobody wants to broach it. They don't want to be called a bigot. They don't want to be called, you know, bad names. Same with we can segue. Nobody wants to be called transphobic.
Okay, you just came up with a great segue while I was around about to double down. I want to just quickly finish up this conversation with the tie into the responsibility that I feel in my responsibility. I feel the church has a responsibility to investigate these matters and to make sure that truth is being proclaimed. Yeah. And so that, you know, even in a liberal society where we're not all going to agree on our political views, at the very least, I have felt that the church has been missing its voice in many of these issues because it is also scared. Look, I'm going to read to you a tweet from my former denomination that came out today. And they say, today we mark the somber anniversary of finding 215 unmarked graves in Kamloops. Let's pray for those impacted by the residential school program and the families impacted by these recent findings. As we explore reconciliation with First Nations people, may we listen first. And then they've put the color up of Every Child Matters underneath their tweet. And I responded back to them. I commented back to them and I said, look, you're being baited. Stop biting at the hook. Mandatory land claim proclamations and being guilted into repenting of sins that you had nothing to do with, and you're showing that you don't understand very much of the situation, is the critical race theory or the critical movement's bait. And they just put it right in the hook. And unfortunately, the church, along with society in general, is missing that point that we're in such a culture where nobody wants to tell the truth for fear of being called a name, that we are actually contributing and we are enabling our culture to deteriorate. Look, with that transition then, let's get into...
My final word on that subject is Christians are in a very almost impossible situation on this topic. And I really sympathize with Christians who don't quite know what attitude that they are supposed to take, because they are proxies for all the bad things that happened in the church. I mean, in the residential
right.
schools.
Yeah. For
and
sure.
So I feel feel sorry for that person, because I know they've been gaslighted into thinking that, but okay.
And that's why we're going to have someone come on the podcast and we're going to talk about it further, because it's these types of discussions that will help inform people. Like everybody, we're going to bait you for that podcast. Like everybody, did you know that Indigenous peoples can't own land on a reserve? I did not know that until I spoke to a politician who informed me that, yeah, that's partly why there's no investment into personal property, because they're not allowed to own personal property.
Well, it's communism, isn't it?
It is literally tribal communism.
It is.
Tr- tribulomulism. You're going to have to use that in one of your epoch times.
You could give me
credit for that. Okay, let's move on and let's talk about one of the hottest topics that I could have never imagined in my entire life that people are actually duped by. So growing up as a man who understands, I grew up with two sisters, I grew up with a mother, I grew up with a father, I grew up in high school. Never in my life could you have convinced me that GQ magazine is going to release a new ad program where they put on the cover a woman who has mutilated her body but still a pregnant female dressed up as a man along with another woman and try to convince the world that men could be pregnant. Like, you could not, like, we could have talked about a lot of things, but you could have never convinced me as a young 20-year-old that we would be living in a world where people actually don't know what a man and woman is. I'm going to keep with this monologue for a moment, Barbara, and then I'm going to let you jump in. Our prime minister, in the last 2 weeks, made a press announcement about the Canadian Blood Agency allowing men who have sex with men to donate blood. And I didn't tweet that day and I didn't respond that day. How is it that you could use the word men? You don't know what one is. So please help us, Barbara. What, like, this is, you know, can you share with us even more facts about what is really going on and how disturbing it is? Of course, we're all lamenting the fact that women are just being utterly discarded in their own sporting events with men who are pretending to be women. And then just please go in and maybe give us some primary examples of your research. That would be very helpful.
Okay, I'll stick to the sporting world because I thought I don't have time and I don't think your listeners would really want me to go into the whole history of the ideology behind this and how it evolved from feminism and blah blah. The fact is that it is a movement. It's a well-funded movement. It's the people at the heart of it are very passionate missionaries for their cause, which is to disrupt and dismantle. It's a revolutionary movement and it is a Marxist movement, or it's based in the idea of a Marxist revolution, which wants to dismantle the powerful, take away power from the powerful and give it to the weak, the oppressed, blah, blah, blah. In this gender version, it's a gender version of the economic version. And in this gender version, the powerful people are the heterosexuals and the binary man, woman, and the oppressed are the people who, you know, the gender fluid people and the, and so it started off with pronouns. Once everybody agreed to use the pronouns, then the next thing was a trans woman is a woman. And anyone who would agree to that was knowingly saying yes to a lie or affirming a lie, because nobody in their right mind believes that you can mutilate yourself or take hormones or put on lipstick and grow your hair and that you have literally become a woman. But they were very keen on everybody saying that. Because once they said that, then it had legal consequences. And everything is like part of a daisy chain of, oh, you agree then that a trans woman is a woman. Well, yes, I guess if that's your belief and I want to be nice and I want to be courteous and okay, a trans woman is a woman. Good. Then we have the legal right to do this and the legal right to do that and the legal right to, and we can be in women's prisons and we can be in rape crisis shelters and we can be in sport. So sport, I said to myself a couple of years ago when this all started to blow up in the sporting world, I said, but, you know, they may get away with it with the prisons and the rape crisis centers because that's far away from most people's radar. But sport, everybody loves sport and everybody loves fairness in sport. So I thought this is not going to fly because people will say, whoa, 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 wait a minute. you know, it doesn't matter if you identify as a woman, you're still a biological male and you're stronger or more powerful and you can't go into women's sport. That's not fair. Didn't I see that you were 400th when you were competed against men in you know, racing track and field, and now suddenly you're number one? That doesn't make sense, does it? Oh, I have a lot of mental determination. I mean, this whole idea suddenly that, well, there's no real major differences between men and women, and that's sort of, you know, not enough to really make all that much. Anyways, so all these lies, suddenly everybody had already been gaslighted into admitting that if you believed you were the opposite sex, then you were. So it's the takeover of certain words and people's acquiescence, because Canadians are nice, right? They don't like to be mean to people. They're compassionate people. And so now we have this situation where activists are now embedded in every Canadian sport association. This weekend, as I am speaking to you, Athletics Canada is meeting in Halifax. They want very badly to create an official policy whereby the only criterion for a biological male to enter women's competition is the simple declaration, I identify as a woman, plus a reduction in testosterone, which many people falsely believe makes a huge difference in the male advantage physically over women. It makes a very small, it would perhaps take away 2% of the advantage, but they already, even with that loss, they still have between 10% advantage, say in swimming, to 130% in rugby or weightlifting or the real power, you know, the power sports. So this craziness, and they say, oh yes, research shows, but they have no research. What they have are, well, they have fake studies that one cites a study, this study that was done by so-and-so, and so-and-so cites their study. So it's all a bunch of trans people that are activists. And by the way, I always have to preface, and we all should preface, gender dysphoria is a real thing. It does affect a very small percentage of the population. It is real. It's been known about for many, many years. When it's persistent, and it can begin in childhood, and it's persistent, I do not deny that that person's mental reality is that they are in the wrong body. I don't deny any of that. But what adults do, but that doesn't mean if an adult wants to get hormones and sex change and whatever they want to do, that's their business. But it does, it gives them the right to be left alone to live their life. It does not give them an entitlement to go into those few areas where biology is the actual basis of the fairness. And so we have this situation.
So I might disagree with you a little bit when my listeners hear me say the words a little bit, they don't mean little bit. I think the reality is yes, gender dysphoria is something that certain individuals need to be treated for and need mm-hmm. to be counseled out of, because you cannot deny your body. When you deny your body, you are literally fighting at the fabric of your own creation. And so even for those individuals who suffer from that, we also know that we have a huge subgroup out of that are now just exploring gender fluidity because absolutely. The nonsense is now right. being promulgated. So you may not be comfortable with this, but I just want to repeat to everybody on the podcast for myself, just so I hear myself saying, transgender women are men.
Yes, they are.
Transgender women are men.
And the honest ones, will say, I know I'm male in my DNA. I know I'm male in my internal organs. You know, I mean, I know I can't change that. But I am desperate, but in my head, I am a woman and I want to, by the way, I do believe in counseling for children who mm-hmm. are confused. My own research tells me that of those children, if you do get therapy, correct therapy for a child before the age of 6 or 7, you can very often help that child to become comfortable in their own body. Our foremost doctor in that area has told me that after the age of 7 or 8, if a child persists, the odds become slimmer and slimmer that they are going to. But he said most children that do present as dysphoric in their childhood, between up to 90% of them realize after puberty that they become comfortable in their body, because they then realize that their sexuality it's their sexuality that they're not aware of when they're little. So
we're talking about confusion, which is prepubescent. Okay,
the point is you're 100% right that this small group of people, most of whom want nothing to do with activism, they just want to live their lives, do not reflect the numbers that are claiming to be non-binary, or, you know, which, by the way, there's no such thing as, you know, that's totally made up. But if you say you're non-binary, I mean, the sporting policies today at the universities and everywhere else is you don't have to say that you are the other sex. You simply have to say, I am non-binary and I identify as female for the purposes of this sport. You can actually, in university, you won't believe this, but you at university sports, you can actually say, this season, I identify as female. The next season, you know, I'm pretty good at javelin throwing or whatever. I identify as male for the purposes of, I mean, they won't be that dishonest about it. They'll just say, yes, I identify as a woman and I want to be in track and field as a woman. The very next year, they may decide that they are such great cyclists, you know, but it's open to them and only their declaration counts. And it's as, you know, I wrote this book with Linda Blade. She wrote the book and I wrote it with her, and she's a high performance coach. And what she often says is, I'm trying to think of the point I wanted to make.
No, it's good. You think on that, I want to jump in for a second, and you just think on that point that you're going to bring up from her, because you're on something. You use the word dishonest, and that is a true word. For somebody to say, I am a woman this month and I am a man this month, in the real world is about as functional as fairy dust. And yet they want us all to believe it. Like, it's like when my kids watch Star Wars and I go, okay, guys, listen to the worldview behind Star Wars. Okay. The worldview behind Star Wars is Buddhism. There's a lot of, you know, pantheism. There's, you know, energy there. The energy can be good or bad. There's no real judgment on the energy. It just is. That's like classic Buddhist pantheism. But kids, what Buddhism in our land out here, they can't make the idol move. Like that is the worldview getting to play with your mind about what can actually happen. And in this world of trans activism, they want us to actually believe that some type of fairy dust comes in and then it actually changes the anatomy, changes the strength profile, changes the tenacity. And you know what's going to happen is if they're going to let young adults be this dishonest, and if ethics really is coming to the end of its own, it will be the end of female sports. Because first generation of guys are going to be like, dude, I'm not doing that. That's dishonest. It's immoral. The second generation of guys are going to be like, well, wait a minute. There's 5 guys in female sports right now. They get to go check out all the chicks in the locker room while they're there, and people are still letting them do it. So then that generation comes in. And by the time you get to the third generation,
It's normal, totally normal.
Well, then it's all the guys that are in that sport, and there's no women's sports. Like,
the thought I was going to come back to was, look, we have a doping agencies to, you know, we have an right. agency that doesn't allow for doping. We had to, because you remember the scandals of the 1980s, yep. Ben Johnson and all that. So they set up this Canadian Center for Ethics in Sport, precisely so that they would be the gatekeepers against cheating in sport. That was their mandate. That's all their mandate was, to stop cheating in sport. So for the first 10 or 15 years, that's what they did with doping, anti-doping. And then they went all woke, and now their main goal is to get men into women's sports. So Linda says, and she's absolutely right, she said, I don't understand. When it was about doping, did you take anybody's word for it when they said, oh, no, I don't dope? Did you just, oh, yeah, of course, why would you lie? Why would anybody lie about doping in sports? So, no, you tested. But when it comes to, oh, I'm totally a female in my head, I'm in my soul, you know, I have a female soul. When it comes to that, it's like, oh, like totally, dude, all right, yes. And so, but the fact is that the doping advantage was about 10%. And the male advantage is usually much higher. Now, here's another irony, is that women who think they're men, trans men, they could go into men's sports, but they don't want to. Why would that be, do you think? Could it be that they won't even get to the qualifying. I mean, they won't get in, is what will happen. But they are allowed to compete in women's sport as long as they're not using testosterone. So the irony is, people are saying, oh, people want to ban trans people from sports. But no, we don't want to ban them. We want them to be in the sport where they belong, or in the division that they belong. And if they're biological women, they're allowed in women's sport. If they're biological men, they should be in men's sport. Period, the end. That's it. Like, it's so simple. Or have a women's category and an open category. That's it.
Well, I think you're being even too generous in that last one. Like, you're trying to be generous, and I appreciate that. But like, you go back to the test. Okay, I either have drugs in my system or I don't have drugs in my system. I don't care what you think you are. Meaning, if you're truly confused about your anatomy, I'm always going to counsel you to love your body and not to deny your body. But that being said, even if you and I are in a room and we get into a wonderful dialogue, and at the end of it, I do have some experience with this in my own personal life with a friend who, as I was a late teen, he was in his early 30s, who wanted to talk a little bit about this and that he was going through this. So I don't lack compassion for the amount of pain that an individual will be going through that. I will counsel them to love their body, and we will often get to the end of a room and disagree. But if I test you, like scientific testing, I can qualify you unanimously as either male or female, like with such small percentages of anybody who would be outside of that this conversation is almost nonsensical. Because of what you're talking about with fairness and what you're talking about with measuring. And the story keeps coming to my mind, Barbara. I remember when I was in high school, we had a fairly good men's rugby team. And one of the girls, there was no female rugby team. So for the last year or for 2 or 3 years, prior to me finishing high school, one of the females who really wanted to play rugby was allowed to play on the men's rugby team. And this was like the big feminist movement. Now, nobody qualified that ever. They never said, well, actually, she's only a kicker. She never comes on the field to actually play the sport with guys, but she is a place kicker. Now, the next year, they started a women's rugby team, and that's fantastic. We had a great, very successful women's rugby program. But for fun, all of the guys from the guys' rugby team said, well, you let her play last year because there was no men's female rugby team. Well, there's no men's field hockey team. So we all showed up to the female field hockey team tryout. Now, this was before everything was so loaded and you couldn't just laugh a little bit, right? Yeah. So the coaches let us show up. We all said, okay, we're trying out. Because there's no female, there's no men's, there's a female field hockey team. There's no men's field hockey team. So we're going to play. And you know what? For the fun of it, they all said, hey guys, you know, we get the point. And these are all your friends and your girlfriends. So sure, go play field hockey with them for the afternoon. And Barbara, I was utterly confused. We had three young ladies who were on that field hockey team that were national or provincial level. I can't remember now. Like, we watched them play and they were brilliant players. None of us had ever picked up a field hockey stick in our life. And what do you think happened when a bunch of men played a bunch of women in a sport that the guys had no previous experience, but part of the sport is running, whacking a ball as hard as you physically can at a target, and one-on-one aggression, like just meaning like there's times when you have to go in just like any other sport and you have to make a normal challenge. I was actually shocked. We destroyed them. And I was shocked by that because valued these women.
I'm not shocked. You know that when the women's Olympic volleyball team wants to do practice sessions to, you know, they play the 15-year-olds at a local high school, the boys. And the 15-year-olds will often beat them. They don't care. I mean, they just want to, they want to get a good workout. Serena Williams, who was the greatest women's tennis player ever, told, I forget, one of the hosts, one of the talk hosts, when they were talking about this issue, and he said, well, Serena, you're such a great player. I bet if you were playing in the men's division, you would have been right up there. She said, if I were playing in the men's division, I would be, if I was lucky, 200, maybe 300. She said, it's a different sport. It's a different sport. And you know, Serena Williams is like, you know, I wouldn't want to be.
That's a big admission.
Oh, she's so real. You know, she's so real. And she's so, she has no time for, you know, this.
That's anyway, great.
She's not political at all. But I mean, she was just, there's nothing to talk about. This is just, and so we're all being gaslighted when they say, our research shows. I mean, look, of course, some fantastic women athletes, like, of course, a great woman tennis player is going to beat an average club player, a guy, but she's not going to beat an elite player. So when you're getting up into elite sport, you've got elite women and elite men. No elite woman is going to be able to touch, you know, maybe she can knock off the last guy on the team if, you know, if they're running, but she won't get near the front. Whereas a guy who's literally 400th against guys did become first. There is a case in our book of he did become first the following year in the women's division. How can that guy live with himself? And worse, how can the coach that's coaching him say with a straight face, as the coach did, yeah, she has such mental determination, like as if all the other girls that he beat didn't quite have it in the mental determination department. Like they trained for years, but suddenly anyways, you know what? I love this discussion, Michael, but it's getting, I see by the time that if I don't get moving, I'm going to, I'm going to not be able to get the rest of the things done today that I have to get done.
No, I appreciate it. We usually take about an hour and we're just right at that line right now. And this is.
But I mean, I've got a few more minutes. I don't want to make you do an abrupt wrap up, but I can't stay for too much longer.
Okay, well, this is great. So maybe last thought, because it's very strange, the conversation that we've had. I feel like we're talking about an imaginary world. I still feel like we're talking about an imaginary world. I still feel like there's even qualifications that we feel we have to give, and we're struggling about an imaginary world. What's going on? Because I gave that anecdotal story about that female field hockey team, and the reality of it is we were all friends, and these were great female counterparts. So, you know, no harm, no foul. It was at a time when not everything was so loaded. What's really happening to these women who are being sidelined by men pretending to be women? Like, can you tell us of the, like, that must be utterly depleting. Like, even the most.
It is so horrible. It is so horrible. And I'll tell you, 20 years ago, when the very first, or it was even more longer than 20 years, but at the very beginning when they were starting to struggle with policies and and at first they had to prove that they had hormones and even sex surgery and all of that, and then it started moving more and more permissively. But years ago, when the women athletes who were being bumped from first place to second and second place to third, whatever, when they would try to speak out, they would actually be kicked off the team, or they would be told, if you talk about it, you will lose all your, you know, you won't be chosen. You will, like, they paid a huge penalty. So they learned to shut up. And that operated, that kind of omerta amongst the women, half of them felt, well, we should be nurturing, we should be accepting, we should, because they bought it. They bought it. And you know how women are always trying to be nice and trying to be welcoming and accepting. But the ones who didn't buy it, they had to shut up. But that's changing. That's what the thing that gives me hope is, that the athletes themselves are starting to speak up. Because, like, as Linda tells me, you know, she coaches teams, she coaches, and she said parents are starting to take their daughters out of sport. They don't want their kids, when they travel to tournaments, they have to allow these boys to stay in the same hotel rooms as girls, as if they were girls. So she says, yes, they are, the girls are getting discouraged. The parents are getting furious. They don't want their, that's the one thing I see changing, is that the athletes, the women athletes themselves, they're fed up. And I think this case in Pennsylvania with this male swimmer, 6'2" and, you know, with shoulders out to here.
Puts a little bit of makeup on. And
yeah, I don't, and I'm not even going to say, maybe in his heart he feels I'm not denying what he feels. What I'm saying is, whether he feels it or not, it was the craziness of his, he went into the women's, he was not mediocre, he was a good NCAA, but in the middle of the pack. Goes into the women's division. He's not just beating these women by a half a second. Like, he's beating them by, like, in the 1650, he came in 38 seconds ahead of the next. Now, in swimming, I'm sure you know, it's usually a half a second, a second. Like, if, whoa, 2 seconds. Wow, that's humongous. So hit that case really galvanized attention. And that was kind of a tipping point. And the women swimmers, at first they weren't complaining and they'd go off to the side and cry, but out of sight of the cameras, because they weren't allowed to speak up. That's changing. And their parents are speaking up. And so you're seeing a bit of a wave happening. And I if this is going to change, I believe, at first I said, you can't expect the athletes to speak up. They're going to lose their scholarships. They're going to lose their sponsorships. They're going to lose this, that, and the other. That was true. But now that there's a significant number of them saying they're not alone, like, it's not individuals anymore. Now it's, they're kind of together saying, no, this can't keep happening. We'll see where it goes. As I said, I'm bad at predictions, but I'm big on hope. It's a sin to despair, is it not, Michael?
I don't know. Jeremiah the prophet, when he looked out over the land, was called the weeping prophet. So I think we're at a time of weeping in our culture. I too, like you, hope for reform, for reformation, for change. But even as I'm listening to, you know, that story, Barbara, we would call that when we would literally call that abuse. Like, that is the definition of abuse in any form, is when there are eyewitnesses to a wrong being done. And like, that's, it's bribery. It is, it's fraud. Like, these are criminal behaviors being, for if any coach said to a young woman, you keep your mouth shut or you lose your scholarship, that individual is engaged in criminal abuse.
And listen, I agree with you, but they think they're part of a glorious revolution or something, or they're just afraid or whatever. You know, people are so cowardly, Michael. I mean, you know that. And you need the few people, the ones that just won't back down. You know, Linda, I think maybe there's more than one now, but for years she was the only coach in Canada who called it like it was and refused to back down. And it's only in Alberta, thanks to her, Athletics Alberta, they have a policy of biology-based sport. But they're the only one of the 10 provinces that do. And she's the only person at that meeting in Halifax today, or there's 3 days of talks at Athletics Canada, the only representative of sport in the 10 provinces that is holding up this official policy passing.
Well, Barbara, I'm thankful for female voices like yourself and for female voices like Linda. I want to make a call out. If you're a father of a daughter in a sport, your daughters need you, men, to go actually represent them and to stop letting these activists run over your nuclear families. We have absolutely this feminization of the culture where we have brave women like Barbara and Linda who have to speak on behalf of fathers. Man alive, if I was at a swim meet and my daughter had just got beaten by 38 seconds by some dude,
yeah,
that boy and I are having a conversation. And I don't, like, it's the professors, it's the administration. We're in this world where everyone is so fearful of litigation that they won't say anything. But you said that earlier, Barbara. Once they get you to say the phrase, then they gain legal ground on you. But if you don't say the phrase, they have no legal ground on you.
It's very insidious because people want to be nice. They want to be accommodating. But they can't see this scam for what it is. Michael, I have to go, yep. But can I just mention my book and the title? And
please do. And if there's a website that you can, that it's available from. So
it's called Unsporting: How Trans Activism and Science Denial Are Destroying Sport, by Linda Blade with Barbara Kay. Just go to unsporting.com. Very reasonable.
Even if it's not reasonable, people, you're not doing anything reasonable anyways. Go out and buy the book.
That would be wonderful if people did, because then they'll truly understand it's not that long to read, but it goes into the whole history of it and the details, and it's pretty crisp writing, I should say, and it won't bog down for you. I think you'll enjoy it, and you'll learn a lot if you read it.
Thank you, Barbara, and thank you for your time. Everybody, please share this podcast. If you haven't shared any of the audio or any of the videos recently, make sure you get back in that habit. But for this one alone, when this one comes out, for the sake of our daughters, for the sake of our nation, for the sake of our world, we have to return to not this mystical world of oppression that is literal abuse. Go out, share this video so people can hear Barbara's voice. Barbara, thank you very much for coming on. And everybody, Godspeed as we go fight this cultural battle.
God bless, Michael, and thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.